I'm Charlie Rose.
I'm Nora O'Donnell.
And I'm Gail King. Hey, this is a CBS This Morning podcast.
Welcome to the CBS This Morning podcast. I'm Rena Ninen. Today we're joined by author Ken Follett. You may know him as the author of The Pillars of the Earth, the man behind Century Trilogy. Ken sold more than 160 million books, and his latest is A Column of Fire. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you.
So this book, it actually takes place in the fictional city of Kingsbridge. Tell me about it.
Well, Kingsbridge is the city where they built the cathedral in The Pillars of the Earth. And I wrote another book set in Kingsbridge called World Without End. And first of all, my readers like it. They know that town now. And secondly, Kingsbridge has come to stand for England, because we've seen Kingsbridge in the 12th century and the 14th century, and now we're seeing it in the 16th century in the new book. And so all the changes that you see in that town over these centuries are also the changes that happened to England. So I've got kind of fond of this fictional city, and happily so of the readers.
You know, it's a fascinating period, the 16th century. You're talking about Protestants and Catholics. Is it hard drawing on a period like this, especially because there's so much history that many people do know, and to be true to that, but also have a license to talk about, you know, fictionalize?
What I do is I take fictional characters and weave their destiny, their personal story, their loves and hates and their fortunes into the great sweep of some historical change. And so you get the best of both worlds, I hope. So you get a story about people you can identify with, people you're interested in, people who fall in love, people who hate somebody, people who get in fights, people who go to war. And you also get the sweep of great historical changes. And in the 16th century, the big earthquake that shook Europe was Protestantism, as you mentioned. For the first time for hundreds of years, there were two rival religions in Europe, and the most terrific and unfortunately the most bloody battles fought over who was right and who was wrong.
Yeah. You talk about these characters, and you described Ned Willard. He's your lead character in this book.
Yeah.
Almost, you describe him as a 16th century James Bond.
Yes. Well, I started to write A Column of Fire because I read a book which said that Queen Elizabeth I had set up the first English Secret Service. And I thought, how intriguing, because we have all read spy stories.
Yeah.
And people love spy stories, but we think of it as a completely modern phenomenon.
Yeah.
And now here it turns out that this was all started 500 years ago. And I just thought, okay, well, what was it like when these guys, you know, obviously it's not James Bond going around in his Bentley.
Yeah.
And martinis had not been invented in the 16th century. So what was it like to be a spy or a secret agent in the reign of Queen Elizabeth I?
And you look into the codes, the secret codes. It's almost like it's the CIA being created for the Queen, would you say?
Absolutely.
And what did you find out? Because you did a great deal of research looking into the codes. What did you find out about how they communicated and how they did their spy work?
Well, they invented so many things that spies still do. So they intercepted people's messages. And because of that, people started sending their messages in code. So they had invisible ink, but it was pretty easy to find out about that. And, of course, finally, they had experts who could break any code.
Mm-hmm.
And the man in charge of the Secret Service was called Sir Francis Walsingham, and he had, one of his agents was a man called Felipez, and he could break any code. Mm-hmm. And so when the message was intercepted and it was in a secret code, Felipez would figure out what it meant. Just like all those spies in the Second World War in Bletchley in England, trying to figure out the German Enigma code.
You know, it's obviously about spies. There's religion. It's also a love story.
Oh, yes.
How do you balance between the fictional and non-fictional aspect of this?
Well, my rule is that I should never violate history. Mm. So I would never say that if a battle took place on a certain day, for example, the great sea battle in 1588 between the Spanish and the English, I would never say that that took place in 1589. I would never change something like that. Because I like to say to the readers, and they like this too, the readers like this, say to the readers, all the history in this book is accurate. I haven't changed anything. And where there are things we don't know about history, that's when I'll make it up. That's when I fit the fictional characters into the true story.
What is it, doing your research, that you feel we just don't have enough about? Is it the little details about Queen Elizabeth? What do we not know that you wish that you could go back, that they had done better record keeping in that time period?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. I guess there are some things that you never really find out about in the research. So if I'm writing a love scene, I might be a bit uncertain about the underwear.
So I guess that's a detail that people are too troubled that we don't know what her underwear was. I would like to know what her cold cream was, but I guess you don't have that detail.
I do, actually.
You do?
Yes.
I miss that.
I'm afraid that in the 16th century, women used a white paste. It was fashionable to have a very, very pasty white skin. And they used a white paste that had lead in it, and an awful lot of people got ill because of
wow.
it.
Wow. That's a fascinating detail. You talk about, you effectively transport us back to the 16th century. Give us a little feel of what that's like, taking the viewer back to that time period that's so long ago. I mean, these folks are dead. Is it hard to take people back? You can't interview any of those folks, right?
Unfortunately, I can't interview any of those people. They're all dead. But I know enough. We know enough. For example, we know that people must have been terribly smelly.
Really?
Just because very few people took a bath more than once or twice a year,
wow.
if that often. And the monks, actually, in the Middle Ages, the monks were the cleanest people because they had to have twice a year at Easter and Michaelmas, they had to have a shave and a haircut and, if necessary, a bath.
Mm, that's so fascinating to hear about this. The research that you do was pretty extensive. Did you travel to these cities to get a better sense of that?
Yes, I very much like to do that. So parts of A Column of Fire take place in England, but also in Paris, in Seville in Spain, and in Antwerp in the Netherlands, which was in those days the richest city in the world. And I like to go there because I have to imagine people moving around these cities, and I have to move my characters from the waterfront to the cathedral to the royal palace and so on. And if I've been there and looked at it, my imagination is free. Mm. If I'm always thinking, well, I don't know, how far is it from the cathedral to the royal palace, and would there be a straight road? Or if I haven't looked at the city, I keep thinking, I wonder if this could have really happened. So it's just that visiting places frees my imagination, and to tell you the truth, I like it also.
You do enjoy it. Who wouldn't?
Yes,
it
yes.
sounds fantastic. You grew up as an evangelical Christian.
Yes.
Do you think that helped or hurt in telling the story?
Well, it helps me because I know the things people. I know the Bible very well mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. I was taught that. And I know the kind of things people say. And I'm sorry to say that the church I grew up in was terribly anti-Catholic, which is a great embarrassment.
I was wondering. It's England, yeah.
It was. I'm an atheist now, uh-huh. by the way. Uh-huh. I don't believe in any religion. I broke with my parents' religion when I was a teenager, and so I see Protestants and Catholics as equal in this story. But my parents certainly didn't. They thought the Catholics were terribly wicked people.
I was curious about your upbringing and how that could have
yeah.
potentially influenced you. You opened the book up here before it begins by a verse in Exodus 13. By day the Lord went ahead of them in a column of smoke to lead them on their way. By night he went ahead of them in a column of fire to give them light so they could travel by day or by night. Why that passage to get people started?
Well, that's where I got the title from, A Column of Fire. And the thing about biblical titles is that they have a sort of resonance. I mean, even to people who don't necessarily know the Bible particularly well, there's a certain majesty about those words that often, and lots of my titles have come from biblical verses. It's a column of fire because in the period we're talking about and in the story, a lot of people get burned alive for their beliefs. It's a punishment for having the wrong religion, people getting burned alive. And also because spies are sometimes referred to as the fifth column. It's a military phrase, the fifth column. So it's also the column is also the spies and secret agents who try to find out secrets.
When you were growing up, you weren't allowed, do I have this right, you weren't allowed to watch movies or television?
That's true, yes, yes. Well, the little sect that my parents belonged to, not just my parents, all my family, uncles and aunts and cousins and everybody belonged to, they believed that the movies were wicked and television was wicked. And actually, we didn't have a radio either. Mm. Here I am in CBS in New York.
Podcasting.
one of the greatest broadcasting organizations in the world.
That's right.
But when I was 7 years old, we didn't even have a radio in the house.
Wow, that's remarkable. How do you think that affected you as an author?
Well, I used to, when all my friends went to the movies on Saturday morning, kids' movies on Saturday morning, I went to the public library. And at the time, I thought this was outrageous. I was very angry about it. Why should I be the only boy in the school who's not allowed to go to Saturday morning movies?
Yeah.
Of course, looking back on it now, it probably did me good. I mean, it probably helped me in my
exactly,
career to
in
spend
a big
every
way.
Saturday morning in the library.
It's so fascinating to hear you say that about how your childhood can impact your career and also the way you tell a story. You also had one of your books, I believe it was Pillars of Earth, Ridley Scott, turned into a television series. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right.
Is it great as an author to have it, or is it a little difficult because you have to let go of control?
It's both. It's both. Of course, it's very worrying. Because I know that the TV series will change the story. They have to, because The Pillars of the Earth is 1,000 pages long, and the miniseries was only 8 hours, and so they're going to have to compress it. I know they're going to have to do it. And, of course, we worry. We all do. I mean, all authors worry about that. On the other hand, it's a real kick to watch the show and have really good actors saying my lines and going and enacting scenes that I've written, and to watch that and think, yeah, I wrote that.
Yeah.
That's a big thrill. And bottom line, you very rarely hear about authors saying no to Hollywood.
That is true. That is so true.
They might have misgivings, but they take the money.
And Ridley Scott at that. How
yes,
remarkable.
That was terrific. I was very, very pleased about
that.
That
is really remarkable. So you're dealing at a time period where you're looking at Protestants and Catholics. We talked a little bit about religious bias and that sort. Did you in any way feel like maybe you were tilting towards one side? You said being atheist really helped you be down the middle. Did you worry that there was maybe more historical fact on one side or more research on one side?
No, I did. I was pretty scrupulous about that, mainly because I feel that you know, one side is not worse than the other or better than the other. It is true that at the time the Protestants were a minority and the Catholics were in power in most countries. So they killed more people, but only because they had the power to. And we certainly know that whenever the Protestants had the chance, they killed people just as enthusiastically as the Catholics. So I don't see any moral difference between them at all.
Mm. You wrote Eye of the Needle in 1978. How has your writing style changed? Has it since then?
I don't think it has changed very much. I pick up Eye of the Needle every now and again.
Mm.
And, I'll tell you what. I was listening to an interview with Paul McCartney, and they said to him, how do you feel about those early Beatles tunes? You know, like She Loves You and all that. And he said, I listen to those tracks, and I think to myself, clever boy.
Really?
And that's how I feel about Eye of the Needle. I was 27 when I wrote that book. And I look at it now, and I think, oh, boy, it's incredible that I wrote that when I was 27. I'm really proud.
That's so remarkable to hear you say that, because I wish that was the same in television. I look back and think, who told me to wear my hair like that? There's nothing that I say, clever girl, when I see myself on TV from back when. What do you hope, Ken, that readers take away from your book?
Well, I think what we get from novels, we don't get lessons from novels. And a lot of people have said to me, because we have religious hatred now and religious warfare now, as they did in the 16th century, are there any lessons to be drawn by study? And I don't think there are lessons, because I don't think we get that. A novel's not a parable, you know, where the end of it is, so now you know this is the way to live your life. What we get from a novel is it broadens our minds, and we learn to see things from the point of view of other people, people who are not necessarily like us. Mm-hmm. In particular, you might read a story written from a female point of view and you might be a man. And so that would... It's not that it's you get a lesson from it. It's just that you learn to see things in a broader way. And so I do think that having read A Column of Fire, when you look at religious strife in the modern world, you will see it from a broader point of view.
You know, you look at America today and just how divided this country is, and the role that evangelicals played, particularly in electing Donald Trump. Are there any, obviously this is a very different time period, the 16th century, but is there anything that can be paralleled or compared to that time, especially, obviously we're not fighting a religious war, but there is a great deal of animosity over very different issues, not necessarily religion. But is there anything during the fighting, during that time period of these two religions that can be drawn to politics today or life today?
Well, I think it's clear that the dangerous guy or woman is the one who says, I know the truth, and I'm absolutely sure that I understand God's will. I understand it. And everybody who disagrees with me is not only wrong, they're a sinner. And that's the attitude that leads us into trouble. It's okay to say, this is what I believe, and I believe it very strongly. That's fine. But when you bang the table and say, and I'm right and everybody else is wrong, that's when there's trouble.
That's a great takeaway. And a lot of people, when you're going through it and you're that person who believes you're right, you're just blinded, completely blinded.
Absolutely.
How long did it take to put this entire book together? There's so much history here, too.
It's 3 years. Column of Fire took me 3 years, and that was a year of preparation, which is research and planning. I plan my books very carefully. A year for the first draft. And then when I've written the first draft, I show it to a lot of people, some editors, some friends who are very good at criticizing me. I seek criticism. And I also show it to historians, experts in different aspects of this historical period, and I pay them, and they write me a report, and they say things like, well, this probably couldn't have happened in the 16th century because, and we discuss how I need to change the book to make it historically accurate. And then I spend the third year rewriting, and I don't edit. I actually key the whole thing again. And there's a reason for that, which is that when I read something I've written, I've got a bit of a tendency to think, that's very good. But if I actually type it again, I see ways to make the sentences better and better choice of words and all that.
I was curious, because if you're playing the piano, you know when you hit a wrong note.
Yeah.
Is it the same when you're writing?
Well, what happens in a novel is that you write something and you think, you know there's a weakness.
Yeah.
And you think... Your first thought is, can I get away with that? Because you don't want to write it again. You don't want to work. And then what happens to me is I think, okay, 10 million people bought my last book, and most of them are waiting for this one. And can I really, if I know something's only just good enough, can I really offer it to 10 million people? And then I say, no, follow. Get off your seat and write it again.
Oh, that's so great. I mean, you are an international, best-selling author, such a following. Is there pressure to keep it up and to not let those viewers who have followed you extensively down?
There is pressure, but, you know, it's good pressure. I mean, I don't lie awake worrying about this, but in the daytime when I'm at my desk and at my keyboard, I do think about those people. Mm. And... the disappointment they'll feel if I let them down, and the pleasure which they'll tell me about if I can manage to entertain them and please them and enchant them with this story the way I did with the last one. So, yes, it's pressure, but it's good pressure. And also, the other thing is, the challenge of writing these books absorbs me completely. Yeah. I mean, it's not like I don't wake up in the morning and think, oh, goodness, I've got to go and write today. I wake up in the morning and I think, I know what I'm going to do next with that scene. I know how I'm going to do that scene. And it's exciting to me and it's challenging. And, you know, not to be too modest, it's great fun to do something that you're good at.
You can tell how excited and happy you are in the process. I was wondering whether it's a tormenting process or whether it, but it seems like something you truly, genuinely, really enjoy.
Yes, years and years ago when I first started out, my agent said to me, your only problem as a writer is that you're not a tortured soul. And that's true. And some, you know, there are writers who are tortured souls, and they write, and their creativity and their imagination comes from their unhappiness. And I'm not one of those.
You're not one of those. I think that's a great note where to end. I want to thank you very much, Ken, for joining us.
It was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Once again, the book is called Column of Fire. It's available in bookstores and online now. And we want to hear from you, our podcast listeners. Email us your questions, your comments, even your suggestions to ctmpodcast@cbsnews.com. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening. You can watch the full CBS This Morning broadcast Monday through Saturday from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. on your local CBS station.
Or you can stream it live on the CBS All Access app.
For more information, please visit cbsthismorning.com.